So this could be a critical year for the Supreme Court. Seems like we always say that. Landmark cases on health care, separation of powers, internet privacy, among others. And in an election year, of course, the court is always an issue. If you've ever thought you could use a quick summary of how cases reach the nation's highest court, what arguments are like, what issues are settled by precedent, which ones are settled, how they're settled. Besides Roe v. Wade, wouldn't you like to impress your friends with knowledge of the relevance of these landmark cases, Marbury v. Madison, Lynch v. Donnelly, or Bowers v. Hardwick? With us today is Linda Greenhouse, author of The U.S. Supreme Court, A Very Short Introduction, part of the Very Short Introduction series. Linda is distinguished journalist in residence at Yale Law School. Linda, welcome to the program.
Thanks very much, John.
So I love this little book. It actually packs an enormous amount of informational power for being so small. In general, part of your mission here is to lay out for people what it is the court deals with and what it doesn't deal with, the big issues that the court is likely to take up. And give us a short introduction of that, if you could.
Well, you know, what I tried to do in the book was to put myself in the position that I myself was in 30 years ago before I had a chance to spend a year at law school and cover the Supreme Court for the New York Times. So, you know, what do people need to know? So I tell the court story in the book with some facts and history, but also examples from rather recent cases, not cases this year because the book was just published last week. But, you know, I suggest the different ways that the court's likely to approach big issues, both the big constitutional issues. Healthcare is an obvious one, although it's not in the book. Statutory issues, which can be very tricky and very important. So, you know, my hope is that people will come away with a framework that into which they can plug the facts that they see on the ground today.
Well, let me ask an I question, I for idiot. what's the difference between a constitutional question and a statutory question?
Okay, so constitutional question, the court has to decide what the Constitution tells us about the controversy at hand. So, for instance, health care. Does the Commerce Clause of Article 1 of the Constitution that sets out Congress's power, does the Commerce Clause authorize Congress to do what it did in the health care law to create the individual mandate? That's a constitutional case. A statutory case, for instance, an example I use in the book is the Americans with Disabilities Act. So major piece of civil rights legislation from 1990. Congress said, basically, thou shalt not discriminate against people with disabilities. Well, what's a disability? What's discriminate? What does that mean in real life? And the court has had a series of decisions trying to parse out the broad general language of that statute. And in Congress's view, the court actually got it wrong, viewed it too narrowly in certain respects. And so Congress went back and amended the law to overturn the court's interpretation. You can do that with a statute. You can't do that with the Constitution. You need a constitutional amendment if you think the court is wrong.
Well, talk about that for a moment. Down through history, is there a lot of precedent? Is there a lot of historical examples of the court looking at a law that Congress passed saying, you know what, you need to go back and rewrite this, or we're interpreting it this way, and Congress saying, you got it wrong, we want to take a look at this? I mean, there's a lot of ambiguity in the Americans with Disabilities Act, maybe less so in some other laws. What bodies of law where this has been a kind of a give and take?
Well, civil rights statutes and employment discrimination statutes are major recent ones. Back around 1988, 89, the court, which was in the midst of turning right, interpreted a series of our foundational civil rights statutes quite narrowly. And Congress got upset and ultimately passed a new Civil Rights Act in 1992 that restored what Congress thought was the original meaning of those statutes. I mean, that was an ongoing controversy that lasted for years. A more recent one that people might remember was the case of Lilly Ledbetter, the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act that emerged from that dispute. And that was a question where the court had interpreted the Anti-Discrimination in Employment, the Civil Rights Act of 1964, to say that you're out of time, you can't get to court unless you have complained about the discrimination within 180 days. And in her case, she didn't know she was being paid less than the men who were doing the same job. She didn't know it for years. And the Supreme Court said, sorry, you're out of time. And Congress said, no, that's not what we meant. and they restored the meaning of the statute to what they thought the meaning should be.
You spend a lot of time in this little book talking about the importance of the Chief Justice and how the Chief Justice's responsibilities are different from those on the court, and that it's important for people to understand that. What would you say is the importance of the Chief Justice?
Well, you know, it's a bit of a mystery because Article 3 of the Constitution, which says there shall be one Supreme Court, creates the court, doesn't say a word in the entire article about the Chief Justice. So you could read the judiciary article of the Constitution and not have a clue that there is even such a job. We only learn about the Chief Justice elsewhere in the Constitution when it says the Chief Justice shall preside in the Senate over the impeachment trial of the president. So really, the role of the Chief Justice is something that Chief Justices over time have created and the court has invented.
All right, I've got a guessing game for you here. Can you tell me whose voice this is?
There have always been tensions, particularly in time of war, between the Constitution's demands of national security, which is primarily the job of the President and Congress, and the judicial demands for securing civil rights of individuals. That's the kind of tension that's written into the Constitution. And what the most difficult job is for our court is to work out that kind of tension.
Linda Greenhouse, you can name that voice in three words.
Stephen G. Breyer, Justice of the Supreme Court.
Talking about the tension between the executive and the Congress as far as working out rights of individuals are concerned, national security being an important tension, any chance those issues will be clarified in the coming years or made more difficult, as we've seen since September 11th?
They will change. They will evolve. I mean, one thing that's fascinating about the separation of powers, the three branches of government, you know, you hear that phrase and you think that they're kind of like, you know, three separate things. But really, it's a very interactive system that the framers set up. And the power of one or the tensions between them or among them really changes over time, depending on the circumstance. Sometimes the court is, you know, the alpha branch on steroids, as it was for a little while during our controversy over the detainees at Guantanamo, when the court pushed back against the executive. Sometimes the court kind of takes a back seat and we see a powerful executive or an angry Congress or whatever. That's one thing that's so interesting about watching the play of the government.
So, Linda, before we go, who's it easier to talk to about the Supreme Court, readers of the New York Times or Yale law students?
I'm teaching a course this semester for first-year Yale law students, and I have to say they're fascinated by the court and they're eating it up, and I'm having a lot of fun.
Linda Greenhouse, distinguished journalist in residence at Yale Law School, author of The U.S. Supreme Court, A Very Short Introduction. Thanks.
Thanks, well, John.
It's unlikely the court will ever rule on whether checking your Facebook page is constitutional or not, but that's exactly what some hiring managers are asking job interviewees, job applicants, to supply their Facebook username and password. And we're wondering, would you do it? A listener in New York sent this text. I'm a naturalized citizen with proudly Jamaican roots, but when an interviewer asked where I was from, knowing it's an illegal question, it ruined the interview. Would you give someone private information in a job interview? Tell us at 877-8-MY-TAKE, or you can post to our website, thetakeaway.org. Don't leave your password there, though. I'm Celeste Headlee.
Oh, leave your password. That
no,
would be cool.
No password.
Leave it. No,
no,
that'd be great.
No.
I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.